The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we still, to a large extent,
live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Michael Brooks is the host of The Michael Brooks Show, the co-host of The Majority Report, and now an author for Zero Books. In this episode, we discuss the election of Bolsonaro in Brazil and the rising right-wing populism around the world. It's Thursday, November 8th, 2018, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. If you like this week's podcast, you should support us on Patreon. Patreon supporters receive access to a second podcast every week. If you're curious about it, then watch this space this coming weekend, as we'll be releasing a special edition of Inside Zero Books with Rob Larson, author of Capitalism vs. Freedom. And that will be available for everyone in order to entice you to support us. Our patrons are helping us to continue and to expand our online production, including doing more podcasts like Symptomatic Redness and Alternatives, as well as to expand the content on our YouTube channel. We currently have 493 patrons. We're hoping to reach 500 patrons by this time next week. The music you're listening to right now is an 8-bit version of Steve Reich's Electric Counterpoint. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to Michael Brooks and I discuss Bolsonaro, the limits of anti-corruption, and the rising right. I guess what I want to start with is just giving you the opportunity to explain your long-term interest in Lula and what you're thinking about or how you're feeling today, which is a day before the second round of the election.
Well, I do definitely follow and cover Caribbean, Latin American, and also to some extent, certainly Southern African politics on my show and Middle East. It's pretty globally oriented, and that's always been my way of going about things. I think particularly for the left, there's a lot to learn from a lot of models outside of the United States. I first remember reading about Lula. I was not even in college yet when he became president of Brazil in 2003. I was a homeschooler, you know, reading at the various libraries around Amherst, Massachusetts, and I read a New York Times report on this bearded former prisoned labor leader who was now going to be Brazil's president. And he seemed fascinating. And then there was several years there where the pink tide in Latin America was the only sort of leftward presence in international politics. And it produced actually a lot of really distinct characters, you know, including obviously Evo Morales, who's still around, but the Kirchners in Argentina, Rafael Correa, of course, Hugo Chavez. Probably Hugo Chavez and Lula da Silva were the sort of main, just in terms of the, although they all had very large personalities, but those were probably the two largest, and they also represented different versions of it, although they were actually pretty closely allied. And that was also sort of Lula's incredible balance he had for several years to have good relations with George Bush, Hugo Chavez, Ahmadinejad, and also be very admired and respected across Europe and Latin America, and then also building a lot of Brazilian ties with Africa. So you had this guy who was, you know, and then I continued to follow Brazil a bit, and definitely was skeptical of the coup. I would definitely call it a coup that removed Dilma Rousseff from office in 2016, and concerned about the trajectory of the Workers' Party. I would say, you know, when I covered it as an example in 2016, I was much more willing to take a more sort of analytic and academic frame on it in some ways. And I think that there are a fair amount of very legitimate and valid criticisms of the Workers' Party, many of which come from inside the Workers' Party. But I also think as this has progressed, it's produced a situation where Lula is the most preeminent political prisoner on the planet. This also, as the historian Perry N. Anderson said in the London Review of Books several years ago, Lula was probably the most successful modern president. And I don't really see where else you can make that case, just even on lifting between 20 and 40 million people out of poverty alone, and radical education programs and development policies, and also a lot of charting an independent foreign policy. So I think there's that. And then I also think that Brazil is headed into a very aggressive form of fascism with Jair Bolsonaro. And there's, of course, it matters in and of itself for Brazil, but even I would say even the things that he's planning on doing to the Amazon, which Lula and the Workers' Party could have been better on the environment, but they actually did make a few strides. If they totally get rid of protections on the Amazon, not only is that obviously a crisis for the people who live there, including indigenous communities, that could be another major effect on global climate systems. So I think that Bolsonaro, and so it fits into a larger thread, obviously, that we're dealing. We can really clearly see whether we're, for all the differences, there is a pattern here of global far right authoritarian politics. And it's surging in Brazil, and Steve Bannon's been connected with Bolsonaro. And it also so happens to be connected with, still at the end of the day, an incredibly, probably the world's youngest social democratic party, one that produced some incredible achievements, and one that was led by a guy who should absolutely deserve all of our respect, support, and solidarity, and whose imprisonment is a travesty, and who would, according to all polls, have been comfortably beating this guy.
If Lula wasn't in jail, he would be the next president of Brazil.
Very likely. All polls suggested that.
Yeah. So
by over digits.
We talked a little bit before I started recording, and for me, the question is, what does a broad left need to learn from what's happening in Brazil? Because it does seem to me to parallel or echo a lot of the things that we've seen over the last few years across the globe, as you point out. I mean, the strides that the fascists are making in even somewhere like Sweden points out that what we think of as a uniquely American sort of embarrassment, the Trump administration, is not. It's part of some sort of global trend. And I want to understand what the forces are that are creating that trend, but not so abstractly that it's useless. You can't just ignore Lula. And you can't just ignore the details of what I guess really took him down and took the Workers' Party down, or seems to be taking them down. And at the same time, you want to see some sort of broad abstract trend if it's there. So and the danger here is to be too critical of Lula and be too critical of the Workers' Party exactly at a point in history where they need us to defend them, exactly when they need our support the most. Or really, maybe they needed our support a couple of years ago. For you, how do you map out the successes of Lula's presidency against the trends and countervailing forces that have led to this moment? How is it, for instance, that as millions got out of poverty, there was still enough resentment built up for something like the World Cup or increase in bus fares to spur on massive protests that then the left did nothing with, and that the right wing was able to capitalize on to undermine the Workers' Party?
Yeah, I mean, going back to, basically the Workers' Party was founded in the 80s. It was part of a broad-based coalition the center of which was the union movement. And Lula was a very powerful union leader and somebody who grew up in extreme poverty and came up through the shop floor and into national leadership. And Ben Fulgu, who's a South African academic, actually has analogized Lula and Nelson Mandela in terms of both their sort of ability to generate national leadership and also because of the sort of the immense prejudices, in this case, class and an identity sense of the Brazilian elite and resentments of a guy who, you know, didn't go to college and was poor and working class and who was much more politically successful and sophisticated than they were. So the Workers' Party helped bring democracy to Brazil in 1988. And as I say, it was unions, liberation theologians, Trotskyites, and probably some relatively more sort of middle class, sort of center left forces. And the Brazilian Constitution is interesting because it actually is pretty is good on labor rights, but it also protected a lot of the sort of military patronage networks, which turned into various right wing political parties, all of whom have actually been totally decimated in this Bolsonaro surge as well. And Lula ran for president several times and lost. And then by the time he got elected in 2003, there's no doubt that the Workers' Party embraced, you know, I would say a kind of camp, a modernization. And so from the beginning, yes, the successes were immense in terms of poverty, education, social advancement, and actually while he was very accommodating and sort of negotiating of capital, particularly Brazilian national corporations, he was not overly accommodating of Western capital demands, which is definitely some of the reasons I think we find ourselves where we are today. He was giving offshore drilling rights to Exxon and Chevron as an example. And during this time of professionalization, there are these huge funding scandals around the PT. Part of it is, which is the Workers' Party. I'm using that's interchangeable. And part of that is because just literally deal making in Brazilian Congress, you have to cut deals with, you know, other parties. It's an immensely corrupt political system and just immensely corrupt. And there's a lot of little parties that aren't even really political parties as such. They're sort of like small groups of patronage networks that shift allegiances depending on who's funneling them resources. There's endless associations in Brazilian politics with, you know, organized crime, graft, just the sort of panoply of corruption.
The Workers' Party was part of a modernization movement in Brazil to bring democracy and legality and but also development, economic development to Brazil, and to use that to lift the very many people out of the slums and into kind of middle-class life. I'm paraphrasing what you're saying here about that. But before that happened, there would also have been the supposed economic miracle of the 70s in Brazil under the military dictatorship. And I guess I think of that as its own kind of modernization project and development project.
Modernization in a specific – actually, what I'm saying – I should be more specific. I actually mean them as a political party. I mean, they're a grassroots social democratic party. And as Lula himself said, in some ways, while the PT is the largest left-wing party in Latin America, they have a lot of similarities, he said himself, with the British Labor Party and the German Social Democratic Party. And what I mean by modernization is that the 2003 campaign was run by political consultants and pollsters, and the PT has incredibly effective advertising. So that transition from a more sort of grassroots mobilized left party to one that was more analogous to the types of politics that you'd see, you know, in industrialized countries, poll tested advertising and heavily funded slick media campaigns. That's kind of more the sense that I was meaning modernization with regards to the Workers' Party. And this is a thing that's very contextual. So I would say big picture before we get to, you know, Dilma and some of the more current events, there's no doubt that did Lula's presidency from 2003 to 2010 did it leave these, you know, major media monopolies that have been so detrimental and used by the right, in fact, to demonize and destroy the Workers' Party? Were they left intact? Yes. Was there a huge amount of work that still needed to be done and wasn't done on the security services and police murders and favelas? Yes. And was there also, you know, just the sort of very ongoing and real question of just sort of structural corruption in Brazilian politics? Definitely. And did they sort of demobilize maybe their base and take them off of the streets in a way that might have been that we it seems like all of us have some sense that, you know, left-wing parties by definition have to have some kind of inside-outside strategy. That's all true. But in the historical context, when, you know, I guess with the exception of a few things happening in Latin America, like Hugo Chavez, which was a really risky bet, there was a sense that, you know, the other side of that equation was a bunch of social democratic and name only parties that weren't really doing anything for labor or for people. Or there was these, you know, and Lula was very much perceived at that time as having struck an incredible balance where he, you know, as an example, he paid off the IMF. And he said, and that was a very Lula move. He paid off the IMF entirely. And the IMF said, well, no, why don't we just roll your loans and keep going? And he said, no, I'm done. Now, you know, other people rightly defaulted on their loans, but Lula wanted to kind of pay them off, be straight with them, and then not deal with them, and then use the flexibility and the economic improvements to, you know, really invest in a real social democratic plan. So I think all of those things are true, and they're contextual, like they're accurate critiques. But yes, you have to historicize a little bit, and it would be very likely if you were a Workers' Party politician or strategist at that time, you might think, and maybe some of them, you know, sure, there was corruption, and you get into power, and you know, questionable relationships with businesses and everything else. There's no doubt about it, but it's also very reasonable, as you might think. We figured out a formula to deliver massive social advancement, keep the economy booming, and also, you know, have pretty good relations with everybody north and south. It would be surprising that somebody would think, this isn't going to work, right? So, you know what I'm saying? So, yes, those are critiques, but I think contextually they would seem the right calls.
Right. Okay. So, how was he able to pay off those loans in the time that he did? I mean, what was going on in the country that provided him with the resources to be able to get out from under the IMF?
Well, there was definitely a commodities boom that Brazil rode. Although that's been a little bit misrepresented, there's no doubt that there's actually a lot of currency reserves in Brazil. And they also did some – I would recommend Mark Blythe explains it better than me, but there's a great Mark Blythe video where he explains how Lula and Dilma basically used like transaction investment taxes to generate basically internal investment and sort of used government to spur – social investment and small business growth in Brazil, which is pretty fascinating. But I think at the time, I mean, that was early in his administration, and he followed a relatively orthodox plan for a couple of years. And then when he reached he had the balance sheet to pay off the IMF, and he just did it.
Right. And I imagine that did not make him very many friends when he did that. Right. I mean, that they couldn't really complain too much, but that's not how the program was supposed to go.
I think there's no doubt, and this is something that Brian Mayer, who co-edits Brazil Wire, which is a really great resource on this, and I'd also recommend a lot of pieces by people like Ben Fogel and Alex Huckley and Jacobin. But what Brian Mayer pointed out is that there's no – that Lula made his peace and cut deals with a lot of Brazilian corporations, but that, you know, he wasn't adversarial to Western capital and institutions, but he didn't kowtow to them. And I think that there's no doubt that, yes, that wasn't the plan.
So then around 2013, I think, is what I've heard, is when the bus fare protests took off, when there was an increase in bus fare. This was out of when Lula was already out of office and his successor was in office. And there must have been some feeling of instability. The weird thing about this stuff is that economic immiseration is not a clean cut thing. Like, you can have people rising up out of the middle class. I mean, rising out of the impoverished classes into the middle class, and they become more embittered and resentful as they get a little bit more stability, because the precarity of their situation strikes home in a way that when they're just sort of suffering, it doesn't. So I'm wondering if it was almost like growing pains or something that the Brazilian people were going through as they came into something a little bit more aligned with prosperity. And but also, to what extent does the kind of the lingering, pretty pronounced and dramatic inequality in the country play into the bus fare protests?
Well, the bus fare protests, I think, actually really specifically hit São Paulo, which is where Fernando Haddad, who's actually running in Lula's place for the Workers' Party, hit. And he actually, what's funny is he actually, of course, he put it, he had a very nice administration, right? With like bike lanes and a lot of, he was also an education minister. I think he was recognized pretty universally, actually, as Lula was back then. I mean, Obama would greet Lula and say, here's the man right here, being very successful and so on. And it's not actually clear to me where those bus hikes came from, right? I'm not sure how that policy was formulated, but there's no doubt that there's an economic slowdown. And between protests against the World Cup and, of course, people, the Olympics and the World Cup are both implemented in just, extraordinarily classist ways, than usually a very corrupt process where, neighborhoods get destroyed, stadiums get built that get used for nothing else, except maybe in Brazil's case, I think they got used as detention centers. And there's a sense of, of course, because of these very real things, I don't know if that the left would respond to it. I think actually amongst the kind of people you're talking about, of people who went from being like, in intense poverty to lower middle class, there's still an incredible residual amount of appreciation and respect for Lula. So I don't know if that's where it came from, but I think that the other parts of the Workers' Party coalition, that both because the conditions were different under Lula because of the economy and also just because of leadership, right? Like Lula, through his, personality, and maybe another fair, criticism of him, is not having enough, successors sort of set in place. Although, Dilma actually in a lot of ways was a very credible successor. And frankly, some things like, Barack Obama and Bill Clinton can't transfer their charisma, right? And neither can Lula. Neither can, some of these things are just sort of intangible stuff. But There was this rise of austerity, anti-austerity, anti-World Cup protest. There's definitely pressure, but somehow this is right before this Lava Jato, this sprawling, massive anti-corruption investigations comes barreling along. And somehow in this process, you will see a huge shift from anti-austerity to this anti-corruption, quote unquote, meme, which quickly gets weaponized by the right in an attempt to absolutely destroy and eviscerate the Workers' Party. And I remember looking at a photo actually before the impeachment of Dilma Rousseff, which happened in 2016, which I know we'll get to in a second, but it was like, it was an upper class Brazilian white couple basically with like their maid walking glumly behind them as they went to an anti-workers party protest. And so, somehow this, and I do think that, one of the overlaps here is definitely a certain type, contingent. It's not that they shouldn't have been pushing the workers party government to be better. And it's not that there weren't some real failures under Dilma Rousseff and under Lula, but there clearly was a lack of strategic appreciation of where this was going to go, particularly when Lava Jato started, among some segments of the left. And even the way, you know, I'll ding, you know, Jimmy Dore, who I don't like, and I'll ding the Young Turks because people said they did it too, who I, you know, I do like people at the Young Turks, but this was just this whole Lava Jato thing was just reported just credulously here. Like, oh, isn't this amazing? Politicians are getting investigated, and not necessarily. And actually, the last thing I'll add to this is the Sergio Moro, the judge who spearheaded this Lava Jato, this cruel, vindictive, awful person with clearly a very sick personal vendetta against Lula. He researched when he was a student in the United States and was inspired by these sprawling anti-corruption investigations in Italy in the 90s, which I'm sure did identify, as they did in Brazil, a lot of corruption. And the upshot of that effect in Italian politics was the rise of Silvio Berlusconi. So I think we rethink this.
Politics based on anti-corruption, and from the way I think of it is, they're almost, this invariably it's a right-wing kind of politics, despite the fact that corruption is bad and you know, you want to stamp out corruption when you can. People who think that the problem with politics today is that the politicians are corrupt are falling for a right-wing trope, as far as I'm concerned, because they don't look into the, you know, as hit my Marxist drum again, the material conditions that set up the terms of the politics and or the history of the situation, or what the ideologies are of the people involved, or who gets investigated and who doesn't, all of that. Back in 2016, the corruption charges leveled at Hillary Clinton had sometimes a little bit of merit, but to focus on those charges at that moment when Trump was coming into power was just sort of obscenely ridiculous. And I think at times the far left, and I think I was guilty of this during the campaign with Clinton, the far left thinks of the Democratic center as stable, as the primary enemy, and also one that's not vulnerable to attacks from the right. And we shouldn't think that way. These institutional norms and the Democratic norms that come out of the Democratic Party in the United States are not written in stone. They are fought for and won, and sometimes you have to compromise to hold on to them. God, I can't believe I'm saying this, but yeah.
Well, should be saying it, because it's really actually the political corollary of your valuing of things like logic, facts, and reason in intellectual culture. You know, there are all of these things. And so this sort of realm of liberal rights, constitutional protections, we should and can critique them all day from a Marxist perspective, primarily in my view, but even also from a postmodern perspective, certainly the reality of how totally, you know, an Enlightenment project that obviously excluded most humans because of either their race or their gender. I mean, this just goes without saying. But it needs to be said and analyzed. That being said, and it's funny, yes, that very narrow, either they're all corrupt or the literalization of and moralism that allows false equivalencies to be drawn, right? Like, oh, well, you know, one person stole $200, another person stole $10 million and has a gun to your head, but yeah, it's all corruption. And it also doesn't get into the actual points that we need to deal with, right? So it's like you look at a place like Brazil, and first of all, these corruption and patronage systems go back to the military dictatorship. We see this right now in South Africa a lot, right? There's this meme on the right that wants to pretend there's a huge amount of corruption issues in the African National Congress. There was a huge amount of corruption issues in the apartheid government. And that's the history of South African politics and institutions. And there is a side that is clearly trying to use that to undermine the idea of a multiracial democracy, which is obviously fundamentally obscene and reactionary. I mean, and so similarly in Brazil, you know, this stuff goes back to the military, which J.R. Bolsonaro explicitly says, like, one of his lines is that the Brazilian military tortured too many people. They didn't kill enough people. And that would have solved more problems. So then it's like, when we look at where, you know, what happened with the Workers' Party. And I actually agree. And I think at this point, the Workers' Party generally agrees that they needed to take on, you know, media monopolies and conglomerates and some of the sort of deals and stasis they made. I mean, literally, these corrupt other parties knifed Dilma in the back in order to impeach her. And by the way, to be clear, she was literally impeached on accounting tricks, which are common throughout the world, like saying, you know, just literally saying like, oh, this ministry, the money that's on surplus in this ministry, let's say it's over here. I mean, it would be sort of the equivalent of impeaching Obama over a questionable report that the Treasury Department,
Put out. Yeah.
So they got on
a technicality because they got on a technicality
and they raged an unbelievable, ruthless, and highly misogynist war against her. And in the end, it was her own vice president from one of these corrupt parties that knifed her. He's the current president. He has, I think, a less than 10% approval rating. He's implemented all sorts of austerity, and he almost surely will be indicted as soon as he's not president, because his things are like, you know, I think there's wiretaps of him like talking about bribing witnesses, right? Like just really clear. But the point being is that we could say any system, really, even if capitalism in some ways is structurally corrupt in terms of wealth perpetuating itself and how that plays out. And then that might be a little bit too abstract, but we could certainly say, hey, the United States even is structurally corrupt, just in the sense that we know that if you go to Washington and you know the right lobbying firms and you have campaign contributions, you get to dictate policy. And that's why pharma and Wall Street and petrochemicals and arms manufacturers have the most power as interest groups. I mean, it's not that complicated. And it's different in Brazil. There's probably, you know, there's more like money in suitcases and stuff, but there's structural corruption and there's institutional corruption. And then there's, you know, the corruption that, as an example, was the Workers' Party, you know, entering into these kind of arrangements and deals so that they could fund campaigns. It doesn't make it right or legal, but that's different than just sort of like pure, you know, venality or being venal. And the third and most provocative is like, you know, they got Lula on these incredibly flimsy charges, which I actually don't even believe in this case. But the bigger point is like, you know, the guy did an enormous amount for his people. And him getting a condo doesn't fucking matter. Like, welcome to the real world. It's irrelevant. It's nonsense. It's a bullshit thing to be worrying about. It's, you know, and people who frame, because even AMLO in Mexico has campaigned on anti-corruption, but he said that corruption needs to be dealt with as part of dealing with poverty because the resources are being misallocated. Well, okay, that's a different message.
Let's talk about what we're going to do next. I mean, if Bolsonaro, I'm not saying his name correctly all of a sudden, but if he is elected tomorrow, what can the left in the United States and around the world do to help the people of Brazil, and how much should we anticipate him? What do we think is going to be the outcome? He's been talking about his nostalgia for the days of the military dictatorship. He's gone far beyond even someone like Trump and the violence of his rhetoric. Should people be concerned about not just police brutality, but police incursion into cities and a rounding up of political dissidents, for instance?
Well, I mean, said specifically that he wants Fernando Haddad to rot in jail next to Lula. And the other big thing that's happened is they have their own fake news thing where they actually illegally purchased a whole bunch of WhatsApp data and used it to spread fake news, like that Haddad, when he was mayor of São Paulo, had like penis-shaped milk bottles for the kids. And that, you know, Manuela Dávila, who's the vice presidential candidate for Haddad and was a member of the Communist Party, that she, like, you know, she wrote, I think she wore like a Jesus Christ Sucks t-shirt or something. And, you know, you have to look at this in terms of a lot of the, you know, whether it's Steve Bannon or whether it's the fact that, of course, the Wall Street Journal supports him and that a lot of Western corporate influence groups support him, but also things like the Koch Brothers Atlas Network, which promotes their extremism across Latin America. You know, there's a lot of overlap. I guess, I mean, look, on the other hand, it's certainly not a majority, but the PT, Workers' Party, actually still has the most seats in Congress. They've elected a fair amount of governors who are actually the ones who technically control the police forces. And you have to think that, you know, there still is a good 40% at least, maybe more than 40% of the population who, you know, oppose this. And then maybe there's a group of people who, like people who voted for Trump, are making an unforgivably stupid, moronic, catastrophic, ridiculous mistake, but they're going to, you know, they've been suckered in with all the anti-corruption bullshit. And then they're going to see that with Bolsonaro, who built his whole career really on authoritarianism and basically just sort of, you know, homophobia and racism. I mean, that really is what he's, I mean, he said, like, you know, his big thing is that people should be able to kill criminals. Police should be able to kill people without ever even facing questioning. But he's consolidated, and the right and the center have broken for him because he's, you know, he has a you know, all sorts of Wall Street friendly economics advisors, and now he's embraced austerity and privatization. And there's been a lot of doublespeak with that fake news too, like kind of spreading fake news to certain networks that labor unions don't have, like he'll protect labor rights, which is not what his campaign is campaigning on at all. But there'll be a backlash, and there'll be, you know, there is a strong counter current in Brazil. And of course, if, I mean, this is a pretty heavy version of a Bernie would have won, but Lula would have won if the, no, Supreme Court, if there was not a lawfare coup backed by the United States, which is exactly what this is. And then here, I mean, Bernie Sanders has actually been great speaking out on this, and they're actually have letters from Congress people, like, you know, people in the Progressive Caucus who both about Lula as a political prisoner, but also about specifically, you know, Bolsonaro's threats to murder people, telling, you know, that the left needs to get out of the country or be put in jail or killed. And I think that, you know, this is, and so I guess on a very basic level, like, we got to keep pushing. Like, I don't understand why AOC or hasn't talked about this yet. Congressman Mark Pocan from Wisconsin actually wrote a piece about this with Danny Glover for The Hill, which covered everything really well, from the political imprisonment of Lula to the rise and threat of Bolsonaro to even the role of U.S. corporate interests in this. And I think we just – and I do think that this is another – you know, if you want to have get over dumb, generic anti-corruptionism and moral purity of politics. And then conversely, I mean, this is a real, like – left-wing politics is not going to happen in one country. And it's very weird to me that, you know, someone like Steve Bannon, who might in many ways is just kind of a media huckster, but he thinks globally, and the left better start thinking globally here. I saw that there might be an initiative soon spearheaded by Bernie Sanders and Yanis Varoufakis for a progressive international. And that really needs to happen. And it needs to happen.
There's a great example of the situation that someone who, say, has been running with Marxists for the last decade is faced with that isn't easy. Because, you know, Yanis Varoufakis and this Syriza party don't have the greatest track record. And right. And if you look at Varoufakis's, like, his writings around Marx or whatever aren't the best, in my opinion. But in a political moment like this one, how can you in any way not embrace an effort like what Sanders and Varoufakis are putting together? I mean, even if you don't believe it goes far enough, even if you don't believe that it is ultimately going to be where our left politics should be at, it is at least moving towards an international left on whatever social democratic grounds that they share. So,
Go ahead.
That's it. So I feel
I agree.
Like you have to embrace it.
Obviously, I think not only is that true, but I also think even in what – so first, I mean, I don't, to be blunt, I don't – you know, I've watched some Varoufakis speeches, and he's, you know, he's a very good communicator. And obviously on the relative scale of things, obviously I support his vision, you know, particularly for the Eurozone and everything else. But, you know, first – I mean, he did actually bail on Syriza because they, you know, capitulated to the Eurozone. So he does have a different. I mean, at this point, Syriza is completely compromised and totally. I don't blame them for that though.
I just feel like they were up against it. You know,
that's the second point that I wanted to make is like the conclusion of what happened from Syriza is not some. You know, highfalutin, like, oh, see, electoral politics, bourgeois democracy. Like, this is not college campus bullshit.
I mean, it would be different if there was something other than that that we had been developing and working on. Like, if there was a furious socialist workers movement or party.
But there's nothing like that. And Syriza was that. And the reason that they failed was because they're part of the Eurozone. Like you and they're a peripheral member at that. I mean, you cannot look, I have no doubt that they've made their own. I mean, the way they played going to a referendum and then bailing on it is one of the most catastrophic, dispiriting things I've ever seen. But that being said, if you just read the Syriza failure as a question of like, moral political failure, it's simply not. I mean, they're in a situation of real institution. They have an institutions hanging over them, literally. So the lesson again is that we need to really be very international in outlook. And I guess I just don't. It's funny with electoralism because I don't think that anything's ever just going to be limited to electoral politics. I think protests, though, are increasingly irrelevant and not particularly effective in today's world. So we have to ask. I mean, I think protesting is great and good for morale or whatever. I think strikes are amazing. I mean, strikes seems to me to be one of the only kind of real potent things that people have left. But there is going to be an electoral component of this. And even just recognize, I mean, even just people understanding the difference of even having centrist corporate Democrat administration where it would actually matter to their electoral calculations if there was mass protests against an immigration policy as an example, whereas under Trump, it might be great. I'd love to have a bunch of hippie liberals out protesting. That will help me further gin up the resentments and racial fears of my base, right? Like people need to really understand, and the left has just totally failed in certain circles of having any analysis of power, and it's embarrassing. And I think maybe that's another reason that I, you know, admire Lula and the Workers' Party is it's one of the only examples that if you're in your 20s or 30s that you grew up with of, you know, not on the one hand, okay, I guess there was Bill Clinton and Tony Blair and Barack Obama who theoretically were on some type of amorphous center left, but really were not, you know, they're not all the same thing. Obama's better than those other two guys, but they're not of the left. And they would be sort of, you know, technocratic corporatists with charisma who knew how to win. And Lula was maybe one of the only one of the only examples, along with some other examples from the pink tide, there was really some great achievements there in Latin America of somebody who could win, understood power, had a real commitment, and actually did have a serious leftward commitment to the redistribution of resources in society.
The truth about what we need to do after Bolsonaro is elected, there's not going to be one simple thing to do. I do wonder to what extent we can rely on the center of American politics to clamp down on Bolsonaro. Will there be sanctions if he, you know, starts to round people up? Will there be any kind of reaction from the center of American politics?
I mean, obviously not under Trump, right? I think, though, that – I mean, definitely not under Trump, right? There are two peas in a pod. But the thing that's interesting to me is that a Brazilian –
What about from the never-Trumpers? What about from the center of the Democratic Party? Will that be a point of – will that be like a weakness for Trump that he's not doing something about this guy?
I don't know if it will be a weakness for Trump, but I actually think that raises a really interesting two-part. One, a point that people will not like at all, maybe, if they're listening from a certain perspective. And a second point that I think we actually really need to look out for on the left when it comes to dealing with the center. So the first point that people won't like, a Brazilian friend of mine, and again, this isn't – I feel like Ben Carson, but it's like I'm not politically correct. And this is like what – this was his analysis of being actually, in his case, an upper middle class but strong, committed Lula Workers' Party supporter in Brazil. And he said, even if Hillary Clinton was president, and Hillary Clinton and the Obama administration have a terrible record with Lava Jato and car wash, and there's definitely support from the U.S., the Department of Justice, for how this played out and how it targeted the Workers' Party. And we'll talk about it more, and I really would hope that everybody would read Brazil Wire. I think it's a great site. And I also will say I've covered this extensively on TMBS. But that being said, all of that being said, if Hillary Clinton was president, it's very unlikely Bolsonaro would be leading in the polls. And part and a big reason is permission giving. So not that Hillary Clinton would want, and maybe even there would still be a judicial coup against Lula and this political imprisonment and all the rest. But he said elites in the world, and particularly developing countries, still look to the United States for what is and isn't acceptable. And there was a sense in Brazil that what had might have been considered beyond the pale a couple years ago, it's like, oh, well, if they did Trump, why the hell can't we have this guy? And it was a permission giving. And I think that that is very real, because I do think politics are also cultural, and I do think that the ramifications of allowing Trump to be president and not understanding the distinction in that choice are definitely part of what has accelerated the rise of figures like that. And to not understand that is really naive. And as you said earlier, it's like basically thinking that in some ways, ironically, it's being the ultimate bougie liberal, because you think, oh, well, of course, history is basically ended, so I can afford to just be a perfectionist and not understand the importance of relative choices, even including two atrocious relative choices, which were, you know, I would consider Hillary Clinton to be the obvious, but of course, also atrocious choice. The second point that is, you know, for 2020, I have no idea how this plays out, but I think it's interesting is that a good amount, as an example, Henrique Cardoso, one of the worst people on planet Earth. He was the president in the 90s in Brazil. He was from an elite Brazilian family. He was actually a Marxist academic who helped protest the military rule. And in the 90s was a president who was very respected and very aligned with Clinton and Blair, advised by some of Clinton's political advisors, and was a nominal social democrat and, you know, had a few social programs, but basically was just a privatizing globalizer and everything else. And his personal resentment and jealousy of Lula is awe-inspiring. And it's clearly the fact that Lula is a smarter, better figure than he is, who doesn't have his education and elite training. And Cardoso has stayed neutral between Haddad and Bolsonaro and gone to Europe just to hang out. And he won't commit to supporting Haddad, even though Bolsonaro has literally said that Cardoso should have been killed. So this is the thing that I would say is, you know, and I think beating Trump really matters. I also think, to be honest, electing Bernie Sanders might be the most significant thing that could happen right now in the context of our world. And I will say, you know, if the Democrats nominate, I don't know, Joe Biden or maybe even a Kamala Harris, the Mike Bloombergs, the, you know, the oligarchs who still want to have elections now and again and don't, you know, aren't comfortable with the most crude forms of racism and misogyny and want some norms, they will support the centrist, center right, you know, Democratic Party. If Bernie Sanders is nominated and he actually wins the Democratic nomination, maybe even Elizabeth Warren, frankly, as just, you know, a liberal, but one with some genuine policies that might actually do things that Wall Street doesn't like. I think it's going to be really interesting to see, not that they would endorse Trump, but, you know, does Michael Bloomberg run for president as an independent in a way that could jeopardize a Democratic candidacy? You know, because I think what we really have to be very wary of, and in some ways Brazil might be an extreme example, but, you know, money breaks fascist. And there might be any number of people who think, oh, you know, it's a shame and, you know, you shouldn't be homophobic and you shouldn't be this, you shouldn't be that, you should be a nice person. Maybe we should even have some modest government programs. But when it really comes, and what's astonishing is in Brazil, it didn't even really come in the form of even having to sacrifice that much. All these people did better under the Workers' Party. But some actual sense of you don't just have unmitigated power. These people break to the hard right. And that is a very real concern.